I'm Christopher Lydon with Leslie Chang's view of the China that has turned itself inside out over the last 30 years. 150 million migrants from village to mushroom city who now make most of all the world's stuff. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one marks the start of the year of China at Brown University. Leslie Chang, your wondrous book, Factory Girls, gave the reader's world two classic drivers, Min and Chunming, 16 or 17 when they made it individually to the factory city of Dongguan, almost a decade ago. They're still young women. Do you know what they're doing, and what does it tell us?
I do. I actually was back in China in March, about 6 months ago, and I saw both of them. And it will come as no surprise to you or anyone who knows anything about China that they've gone through immense change even in the 3 years since the book came out. Min, who at the end of the book has landed in a purchasing job in a factory, which in China is a very good job, basically because you can get kickbacks and make a lot of money on the side. She got married and bought a car, bought a used Buick, and had two girls, and is now living in her husband's village near Changsha in Hunan province, and is thinking of starting a restaurant business. And that all happened in the past 3 years, amazingly. And Chunming, who is an older woman who I write about in the book, she's still living in Dongguan. She's probably had six jobs since the end of the book, jumping from one industry to something completely different. She's now working for a chain of traditional Chinese tea houses in sales. And she's always telling me about her dating adventures, which are usually catastrophic or funny or interesting or whatever, how you want to look at it. But, you know, she's in an unusual situation of being a 36-year-old Chinese woman who's not married, which in the cities is becoming more common, but in the countryside is still it's basically a taboo because she's not bringing grandchildren to her parents, and her parents are constantly reminding her of this fact. So she's under a lot of pressure. Even as she's become a very modern woman, she's also under a lot of traditional pressures.
I thought she had almost resigned her big ambitions at the end of Factory Girls. She was talking more broadly about making a contribution to society, but it wasn't about her anymore.
I think that what you see, the changes in her are very interesting because I think she's moving away from just, I want to make a lot of money, I want to buy an apartment and a car, all those middle class aspirations that so many Chinese want. And I think she is trying to look for something that makes her feel healthier and happier and fulfilled. And she doesn't always have the words for it, and it might be a pyramid scheme involving health supplements, you know. But what I found interesting about her is that she isn't that sort of striving materialistic person that we always think about when we think about China. She's actually looking for something more. She just doesn't quite know what it is.
Leslie Chang, your Factory Girls became a sort of instant classic that reminded me of two others. Charles Dickens's American Notes on the Lowell Girls in Massachusetts, 1830s and 40s, about American girls coming off the farm in the first industrialization of this country, but also of Isabel Wilkerson's book called The Warmth of Other Suns about the great black migration in the 20th century, vastly smaller than what's going on in China today in numbers, 10 million over 50 years, but an absolute transformation of American culture, especially in the mix with the migrations from Eastern Europe of Jewish migrants and then refugees. It had an explosive cultural effect. The music we listen to, the books we read, the sports we see on television are all in certain ways shaped by those migrations. And all through your book, I kept wondering, what is the expressive change going to be in China, the cultural change, the thinking, identity change in the long run of this fantastic reconstitution of that population? Any guesses? It's going to take a while.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up the Lowell girls and also the migrations of the 19th century, because these were really in my mind even when I conceived the book. And the reason I wanted to write about these young women in factories was I felt like the outside view of them was that they're slaves, that they're victims, that they're oppressed, they're faceless, they're masses, you know, all these kind of stereotypes we already have of the poor in China. And I felt as I started to report this story that this book, that in fact, there are a lot of commonalities with American history. These are people who are leaving their homes to find a better life somewhere else. And we saw this in Lowell. We saw this in Eastern Europe. We saw this in the American South. These are really stories about journeys and opportunities and adventures and, of course, hardship and oppression, but also finding a new life for yourself. And so I hope that the readers would understand that these people aren't that different from me, you know, and I can understand them, and I can understand their stories, and they're sympathetic, and they're interesting, and maybe there's someone in my past who was like Min or who was like Chuen Ming. And in fact, when I wrote these first stories for the Wall Street Journal, I got a lot of letters from people who said, Min's story is the same as my grandfather's story, or, you know, my great uncle also came from Ireland and worked in the factories of New York, and I have his diaries, and this makes me want to write a book about them, you know. And so I was really, really inspired to get these letters because that's kind of one of the things I wanted to do, is make China not so foreign, but make the individual stories ones that people could connect to. In fact, I actually thought about including a chapter about the Lowell girls in my book, and I did a lot of research, yeah, and, you know, reading a lot of their diaries and letters from when they worked in the textile mills. And I ended up not doing it because I felt like even though there were nice emotional resonances, there were also so many differences. I mean, one big difference is that it seemed like the town fathers in Lowell were very proud of these girls and how they were very industrious and, you know, working hard and doing these knitting societies and poetry societies and all these things to kind of improve themselves. And that's so different from China, where the town fathers just don't care anything about the migrants, these poor, uneducated people. You know, there's just such a huge class divide in China, educational and material in that way. And so I felt like the stories were so different that it would be misleading to include this American history in that book.
The Lowell girls, as you say, had a literary magazine, or more than one probably. They also had a kind of political thing going for a while together. Not radical exactly, but it was a foretaste of unionization and activism.
Yeah, there's really nothing like that in China. And that's another reason why I didn't end up including this American piece of history in my book. In China, the phenomenon is economic and it's social. People's lives are changing because they're making more money and they're having the freedom to make their own decisions and to challenge their parents. And all those things are, of course, extremely important and transformative in their own lives. But what I'm not seeing really is a cultural impact. You know, I did not see people who were starting their own magazines or creating their own proto-unions or writing pop music or short stories. You know, that whole thing maybe. You know, I think China as a whole is not at that point yet, which is not to say that there are not many people capable of doing it. But right now, I think the focus is very much on, I did not have this opportunity in the past. I want some money. I want some stability. I want some comfort. And then I can think about the life of the mind or what I want for my children or what this really means. I just think kind of psychologically, because of where China's coming from, because it's had a century of very catastrophic, unstable and traumatic change, people are not ready to really process all the things that they've been through yet. So right now they're just go, 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 let me get, let me strive, let me obtain, and then I can sit down and start to think about what it all means. And
I'm still in the spell of Isabel Wilkerson's book about 20th century migration in this country. It too came out of centuries of hardship, but it created Motown music. It created the National Basketball Association, created the Count Basie Band. It created Miles Davis playing George Gershwin's Summertime was something that had never happened in the world before. Or John Coltrane's variations on My Favorite Things by Richard Rodgers. It created the way we think. And surely millions and millions of Chinese coming to an urban global context is going to change us all someday, but I want you to guess how.
Well, I don't think you should discount the fact that millions of people, hundreds of millions of people, are able for the first time to leave their villages of poverty and idleness, especially young women who had no opportunity, and can suddenly choose how to live their lives. I mean, isn't that enough? I mean, it's an amazing change, and it's an amazing change that has never happened in China before. And take it out of the American context, that's one of the things that I think we need to do when we look at China, is it's not coming from the same place at all. It's coming from a view of history in which history just repeats. One emperor rises, the emperor falls, another emperor rises, another emperor falls. Then we had Chiang Kai-shek, then we had Mao Zedong. Every single time you look to the emperor and you buy into whatever the policy is that he's embracing that day. And all that is now gone. I mean, that is amazing. I mean, modernization has come to China finally in the 1980s. Because of Deng Xiaoping. I mean, that is so recent. You know, what you're talking about is change in America that happened over 150 years. I mean, you know, China needs some time to digest all these things that it's gone through. So I think right now this is what the people are focused on, you know. And I don't know if you've been to China, but when you go, what strikes you is just...
Not yet.
Yep. Everyone is working all the time. It's like the workaholic journalist's fantasy nightmare. You know, you are interviewing, you go and interview people Saturday night at 11 o'clock, you know, and then they call you Sunday morning at 6 a.m. and then you go meet them again. You know, it's just everyone is working constantly and really focused on getting ahead and what comes next. And there's just this speed and intensity, and it's amazing. But what you're talking about is the space for creativity, for meditation, for summarizing and thinking about meaning. And I just don't think that's where kind of the national mindset is.
But I'm also thinking of all the little evidences of something new in the way of individualism.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Almost, forgive the American reference, but an almost Emersonian self-reliance. You're on your own.
Certainly, certainly. Yeah, in that sense, it's very American, which is one of the things that drew me to it. And that's why things like the self-help movement, which is quintessentially American, have found such purchase among Chinese migrant workers, is because they relate to this idea that you're all alone and you're on your own and you can make or break yourself, but no one else is going to help you. Yeah, certainly there are very strong American echoes in that sense. It is an amazing change. I'm just saying I'm not seeing the cultural effects right now. Mm-hmm. And another thing that's very I wouldn't say unique to China, but you know, specific about China is that the intellectual class are the people who write the books generally, and they are not interested in the migrant workers. The intellectual class likes to write about themselves. And it's very different from America, where there's a great pride in, I'm going to go learn how this community of migrant workers or this community of whatever, transients or homeless people or whatever, how they live, and I'm gonna write this in a respectful and hopefully beautiful way, and that's a great piece of work. In China, there isn't that tradition, you know. So the people who are sitting in their offices in Beijing or their apartments, they don't really want to go and spend a year among these very uneducated, very dirty people and learn how they live, you know. So even though you have this great, amazing transformation going on, I don't think it's having much impact on the cultural and literary life of China.
Leslie Cheng, come back to the intellectuals and the story writers and the playwrights, the poets, the artists, the professional expressive class. Where does an American go in that marketplace, so to speak, to start getting our heads around China?
Well, you know, I think that there is a lot of writing about what's going on in China right now. In fact, right now I'm doing an article about Chinese bestsellers, and there's a whole class of a genre of books that have come out in which people are discussing, you know, the workplace and how to get ahead in the workplace. And these stories actually tell a lot about what's going on in China. There's a whole range of stories about how to succeed as a government official and what really goes on in officialdom. And I think these are very, very telling stories about what's really going on in Chinese society. But these books don't get translated into English. And, you know, what you see translated into English are generally still memoirs of the Cultural Revolution and satires about, you know, political events of the past. I think that that's a lot of what these Chinese intellectual writers are writing about. And in many cases, it's because some of the most prominent writers live in exile or live abroad, and they're not really engaged firsthand with all the changes that are going on in the country. The things they know about are what happened in the 80s when they were children, or what happened in villages during Cultural Revolution because they know about it or they studied about it. So I don't really feel like the literary class is focusing on all the changes going on right now as much as they might be. And I think another reason is that I think right now the places to be for smart, talented, creative people in China, the place to be is business. That's where all the really smart, bright minds are, because that's where the opportunity is. That's where the freedom is. We're not even talking about wealth. We're talking about personal freedom and space to do what you want. So someday that will change. But right now, that's where, you know, I have lots of friends, lots of bright, talented friends, you know, among the more elite class in China, and they're all in business. You know, these are not people who are sitting home writing novels. These are people who are out developing buildings and, and selling fashion clothing. And, you know, I mean, that's kind of where the opportunity is right now. And so maybe we shouldn't be that surprised that there isn't a Dickens in China right now. The Dickens is doing real estate, you know?
But what a gap it leaves. I mean, is this any way to live?
It's a very hard time for people now. And from the outside, you would think that this is a time of incredible excitement and opportunity. People can leave home. They can change jobs. They can marry who they want. They can travel abroad, all these things that we know about reform era China. And that's great. But when you're in the middle of it, it doesn't feel like, oh, I have great opportunity. It feels like, oh, my God, there's so much stress and everyone is getting ahead and I need to get ahead. And if I don't get ahead, I'm going to fall behind and be forgotten by everyone. I mean, people always say this to me, you know, I must improve myself or I will be eliminated by society. That's the word tao tai. It's like I will be eliminated by society. Like you're a cell phone that someone throws into the road because you're like an outdated model. You know, I mean, that's really kind of the metaphor. So I think there's incredible stress and pressure that comes with this incredible speed of social change. And for people living through it, it's very, very hard. Not that anyone would go back to the old days. I mean, people talk about the old days when everyone was equal and things were much more relaxed. And you'd go to the office just to read the newspaper and drink tea and gossip with your colleagues. It's nice, but no one wants to live that way of life. And if they did, no migrant would ever leave the village because that describes the life in the village. You know, you're not starving. You have enough to live on. It's just boring. There's nothing to do. So everyone knows that their life now is really hard, but they wouldn't go back to what they had before. And
is there any relief in sight from the stress that people face?
You know, I think at some point things will slow down and things will become more quote-unquote normal. You know, when I was writing about this 10-year-old girl living in Shanghai and having this life of incredible stress, I was thinking, you know, her mom's life, her mom is about my age and, you know, early 40s, her mom's life has seen incredible change. She grew up during the pre-Deng Xiaoping reform years. You know, she knows what it's like to be hungry or to only have meat on New Year's or a couple times a year. And now she's living a middle-class life with an apartment. They go out to dinner every couple of nights, and she's wearing nice clothes and has a nice cell phone and is doing all sorts of things at work. But Bella, the girl I'm writing about, her life will not see that level of change, you know, because she's already grown up in a world of material comfort, relatively speaking. I mean, the changes in her life will only be incremental, I think. So as we move into the next generation of these young people who grew up during the reform era, in fact, in China, they have a word for this exact class of people, which is the post-ba-wu-hou, the post-85s, people born after 1985 who have only known material security, comfort, and choice. People who grew up studying English in school and taking piano lessons and, you know, buying stylish jeans at the department store. Of course, this is all like middle-class urban people, but that's 200 million people. So these people will not see that kind of will not feel, I think, that incredible anxiety and pressure, but will feel more comfortable, more adapted, more entitled in a way. That's what their elders say to a certain way of life. So I think that things will slow down. And I also think that some people are turning against that sort of incredible, intense success at all costs mentality. And you're seeing that in, you know, there's kind of a new group of people in China who are the dropouts. You know, whoever ever heard of a Chinese dropout before, you know, but there are people who are choosing to get off the career track and to go live in more, you know, nice backpacker places like in Yunnan province and drink tea and live off very little. And, you know, I know some of these people, or I actually have female friends who are dating some of these people and are very frustrated with them. People who left high-powered careers as brokers and bankers to go live a different way of life. And, you know, it's very surprising for China, but obviously, you know, it's healthy to have that option, right? And maybe after a few years, they'll come back and do something else, or maybe they won't. They'll just kind of be lost and do their own thing. And that's part of reform and opening, right? You can do what you want with your life, even if you want to waste it and not do anything.
Leslie Chang, come back to this persistent thread that As you write, the Chinese today have a troubled relationship with their past. It's individuals and families. It's also, in some sense, the nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, you know, when we look at modern Chinese history, basically from 1850 to 1980 is just a time in which China was intensely trying to figure out how to become a modern nation and how to deal with the West and how to no longer be what they called the sick man of Asia, the country that was once dominant and now has fallen into degeneracy and irrelevance. So, you know, we had the Opium Wars and then efforts to modernize at various times, the 1911 revolution, you know, decades of civil war and the World War II, and then we had the communist revolution and then the anti-rightist movement and then the cultural revolution, you know, on and on and on. So these are all somewhat, you know, often very traumatic events, but I think what ties them all together is this effort of China, the nation, to figure out how it fit in to the global world. And Mao's solution was, during the Cultural Revolution, was let's go backward. Let's just do everything the opposite of how the West does and show that they're wrong. And through this, we will become a modern nation. Of course, that was completely wrongheaded. And with Deng Xiaoping's reform starting in the late 70s, it's let's learn what we can from the West. Let's do it experimentally. Let's let in bits and pieces and see how it works. And that's kind of still where we are. So I think that when we ask, you know, why Chinese are not more introspective about the past, the reason is that there are so many traumatic, painful things that happened. And it was not all things that were imposed from above. Many of the things were things that people did to each other. And, you know, when you talk about the Cultural Revolution did not happen in a Beijing, you know, political office. A Cultural Revolution happened in every classroom, in every university campus, and many villages and many households, you know. And it was students attacking their teachers and, you know, university students attacking their university president, in many cases hounding them, beating them to death. It was people in villages, the poorer people turning against the richer people with the guidance of, you know, Communist Party cadres, you know, taking property from the wealthy people, beating and killing the wealthy people in the village or people they just had a score to settle with. So, you know, these are really, really painful things. And once you start talking about it, you can't just say it was all the fault of the Gang of Four, which is kind of the official Chinese take on the Cultural Revolution. Let's blame it all on Jiang Qing, Mao's wife, who is one of the most visible radical people leading the movement. Let's all blame it on her and three of her cohorts, and everyone else gets off scot-free. I mean, that's basically what the official view of the Cultural Revolution is right now. But if you really get into it, you know, most people were culpable in some way, and it's not to point fingers. It's just to say when you want to survive in that society, there are a lot of horrible things you have to do to protect yourself and to protect your family. So I think that now, you know, what happened in 1980 was there was a sudden 180-degree about face, which everything that was bad before is good now. You know, all those things you got attacked for during the Cultural Revolution, like learning and scholarship and business and doing small business and making money and having some nice furniture, all those things are now good. Okay, now you go do them, you know. And what is the psychological cost of suddenly making that kind of a drastic shift for a whole country? You know, the cost is, okay, we'll do it. We like this new life, but let's not think about what we did yesterday because it's really painful and it'll bring up all these questions about why did we do this? Is there something about Chinese culture or family culture or village culture that made us suddenly turn on the people we lived with all our lives, you know? So I think that this lack of introspection runs very deep and is tied to these very painful things that happened. And, you know, I think in America, our natural instinct is someday there will be a reckoning. You know, we are going to lay all these things open the way we can lay open all the horrible things that happened during the Holocaust. And, you know, not to compare these two things, but to really get all the details so we can give full respect to all the people who suffered and to really understand what happened and to hopefully ensure that this never happens again. But in China, I mean, I think it's really likely that this can just be papered over and people will move on. And I don't know. It's hard to say.
You lived the story yourself in your own family, sort of probing into what looked like the murder of your grandfather, a brilliant guy who'd come to the United States in the 20s, got a Michigan degree, Chicago degree in mining, was part of the effort after World War II and the defeat of the Japanese to reclaim those mines for China, but he ran afoul of the Communist Revolution and was killed. This was a tough story to tell and to confront in your own family. What's the moral for you, for all of us, out of that inquiry?
Yeah, I think what was amazing to me was that there was this family story that I'd always known about, my grandfather being killed when my dad was 10 years old in very suspicious circumstances, and that no one ever really told me the story. You know, I'd always heard about it as if I should know about it, but no one ever sat down and told me the story. And finally, I was, you know, 36 years old and writing this book, and I sat down with my father and I said, okay, I want you to tell me what happened. And he told me, you know, and it was then I started delving into what really happened to my grandfather and this larger story of what happened to our family. And I realized that there had been kind of this, not like a willed suppression, but kind of like everyone had collectively agreed, that's all in the past, let's move on. You know, it's sort of like the story of what happened to my family, which didn't involve just my grandfather, but many other people who were tortured to death in the Cultural Revolution. It really was kind of the story of China, you know, writ small in my family, was that very painful things had happened and people had just moved on because there was no benefit in dwelling on these sad things or in figuring out what really happened or why it was so painful, you know. And along with that story, I went and visited my father's cousin and his family who were still living in China. And I was talking to them and you know, trying to get to know what happened, because my father didn't even know what had really happened to his uncle and all these people in his family because they were still in China during the Cultural Revolution. And, you know, I remember this long, long, day-long kind of meal. I sat down with my dad's cousin and her children, and we talked and talked and talked. And after about, you know, 8 hours, you know, she turned to me and said, you know, do you know that my husband's father committed suicide? And I said, no, I didn't know that. And then finally she started to tell me the story of what happened when he was, he basically had been living in the city, but he returned to his home village during the Cultural Revolution because people said he would be safer there. And basically they attacked him and criticized him as a capitalist rotor or a wealthy person, and he hanged himself, you know, the next day in a tree in the front yard of his house. And then much later, I learned what happened to his wife. And basically, she was already dead by then. But what happened was, in the first land reform movements in the late 1940s, the villagers had kind of turned against the wealthy people in the village, and they just beat her to death, you know. And no one ever mentioned that to me. You know, it was only much later that I sort of pieced it together. And, you know, when you – I mean, these are – you hear these stories, you're like amazed and moved. And you would ask them about it, they would just say, well, it happened to everyone. What's the point of telling you the story when it happened to everyone, you know? So, I mean, what's the moral? The moral is it's important to treat each story individually and to feel its full importance, because each story matters, you know? And I think the feeling you get in China is people feel like when it happened to 100 million people, it didn't really happen. You know, that thing about Stalin, right? You know, 10 people dead is a tragedy. Right. It's sort of like if it happened to everyone, it didn't really happen. You know? So I think sort of our role as storytellers is to find these individual stories and give them their full importance.
Leslie Cheng, you're such a model explorer of a story we all want to know. I can't thank you enough for Factory Girls. Thank you for this conversation, too.
Thank you very much.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.